Last week we looked at the issue of sexual sin at the Church of Corinth, specifically the practice of some members of engaging with temple prostitutes. Some of them were committing acts of fornication and adultery. As we know, the goddess Aphrodite was worshipped at Corinth, and one of the expressions of that worship was to engage with temple prostitutes. So Paul says in verse 16, this is in chapter 6, verse 16, "Do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two," he says, "shall become one flesh." Now explain the reason why they were doing this, and we'll touch on it again in a moment. But in response to this situation, Paul set before the Corinthians five doctrines to change their thinking and to bring it in line with the will of God. I'm not going to go over those five doctrines again tonight, but to sum them up by saying, Paul makes the point that the body is important. It was made by God. It's made for God's glory, and what we do with it matters. Sexual practices, though they are physical, can have deeply spiritual ramifications or consequences. Now, as we come to chapter 7, Paul continues on in a similar vein. He addresses further the issue of sexuality, and he also then draws into view related matters such as divorce and singleness and marriage. And so chapter 7, if you read through it, it's quite dense. There's a lot going on, and I don't intend to look at every issue over the next couple of weeks, or rather, I don't intend to go through every verse by verse, over the next few weeks, but we will touch on some of the main themes. So let's read chapter 7 and the first 7 verses. "Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment, for I wish that all men were even as I myself, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." We're going to focus our thoughts on the first five verses. And as you can see, they're primarily concerned with the issue of marriage. I hope when we come to marriage in the Bible that some of us don't switch off, because there are people, of course, among us that are not married or thinking of getting married, or young people, there are single people. So don't switch off. There are still principles that are important that we can learn from. I trust that such subjects will still be a blessing to us, even though they may not always be specifically relevant to our circumstances. So we're going to look at the issue of marriage here, and a problem in the Corinthian thinking in relation to marriage. So the first thing I want us to consider is marriage and sexuality. Marriage and sexuality. Now, if you remember last week, I spoke about the influence of Platonism. So Platonism is a particular kind of philosophy. And Platonism basically said that physical matter is evil and it's temporal, and that includes the human body, whereas the soul relates to God and it is eternal. And this philosophy led to two extremes in terms of behavioural responses. Some people, seeing the body as evil and temporal, thought that they could indulge the body in any pleasure that fancied them. The body was of no real consequence, and so they could just indulge themselves in anything. And it's for this reason that some in the church in Corinth were going in to visit prostitutes. They felt that it had no spiritual significance at all. They regarded the desire for sexual gratification to be no different than feelings of hunger. What happens when you're hungry? You eat food. No big deal, it's second nature, we eat food. And they likened that to the desire for sexual gratification. If you feel like sex, well, you can have it. Doesn't matter if you're single or you're not fulfilled in marriage, you can go into the temple prostitutes. So that was one extreme. That was, you know, one end of the scale. The other end of the scale is people regarding the body as evil and temporal. Rather than indulging the body, they thought that they ought to punish the body. They ought to afflict the body and go through periods of abstinence, denying themselves all kinds of legitimate physical pleasures. And it's this second approach that we also see taking place amongst the members of the Corinthian church. So there's these two extremes, self-indulgence and also self-abasement that led to affliction and abstinence. Look at verse 1, chapter 7, verse 1. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. So Paul had received correspondence from the Corinthians in which they asked a number of questions in relation to sexuality and marriage and other things, as I've already touched on. And he begins by addressing these questions by touching on those who are championing the idea of celibacy. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, he is going to go on and speak about the advantages of singleness. And there are advantages to singleness in terms of having the time and the energy and the resources to give yourself to the work of the Lord. But he does not refer to singleness as a good thing in terms of physical abstinence and not marrying and giving yourself to marriage and enjoying sexuality. And so he's very careful that, for them to understand that singleness can have advantages if you choose to be single in certain ways, but not by abstaining from the desire for physical intimacy. Paul emphasizes to them very clearly that marriage is good and it has a rightful place. Reading verses 1 to 3. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. If you choose to do so, it has a place. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. If we go back into previous sermons and what Paul has touched on with regards to sexuality, he's dealt with sexual sin on a number of levels. There was a man sleeping with his stepmother, and then there was this whole issue of them going into the temple prostitutes, which we looked at last week. And so he's been dealing with sexuality in a fairly negative light, we might say, sexual sin. Now as we come to chapter 7 and he's addressing some of the questions that the Corinthians have, he's able to put sexuality in a much more positive light. Desire for physical intimacy is perfectly natural, and God has provided the context for it to be expressed. This takes us back to the beginning, Genesis chapters 1 and 2, and God's purposes in creation. Oliver read earlier to us Genesis chapter 2. Let me just recount a couple of verses. Genesis 2:18. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." And then verse 24. "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." And so it's clear that God created human beings as sexual beings in order, on the one hand, to fulfill his purposes in the earth, to bring forth children and to subdue the earth and to populate the earth and so on, but also he created sexuality, he made us sexual beings in order for our enjoyment. And it's to both of these ends, his purposes and our enjoyment, that he has given to us the union of marriage. It's interesting for us to note that God never intended human beings to find all of their fulfillment only in relation to him. Now, of course, without question, God created us to be in relationship with him. That is always to be the priority. But God actually created us to enjoy many things in life. He's given to us many blessings to enjoy in life. We can enjoy creation itself. We can enjoy the arts. We were designed to enjoy human relationships, friendship and companionship, including marriage and intimacy within the marital union. It's the closest, strongest, and most important connection two people can have. Coming away from Genesis chapter 2 and back to 1 Corinthians 7, I think what we find here is that Paul emphasizes a very important principle in terms of the language he uses and what he's conveying. Now, it's true that many people have a low view of marriage and a carnal and debased approach to sexuality. But I think it can also be said that there are Christians that can have a very prudish and also unbiblical approach to sexuality and to marriage. Many years ago, a fellow pastor, a friend, related to me a conversation that he had had with a couple, and I can't for the life of me remember the context, whether it was pre-marriage counselling or some kind of counselling or just a conversation, but a wife said to him that when she was preparing for marriage, that her mother took her to one side and said to her, "Now, when you get married, make sure you don't overindulge in the physical side of the relationship. It's not healthy to overindulge." The mother said to her, "In reality, sex is given to us first and foremost for the procreation of children. And once you have your children, then really it's a good and wise and healthy thing to sort of largely withdraw from that side of life." We don't find that kind of thinking at all whatsoever in the Bible. I think in a similar vein, there can be an almost over-spiritualizing of the marriage union, as though the desire for sexual intimacy is a very secondary and even perhaps we could say unworthy reason to get married. I remember also being told of a conversation that occurred between a well-known minister and a group of young men. It was actually here in Sydney many years ago. There was some kind of conference on, and this pastor was here as one of the speakers, or the speaker. And during the lunchtime, this conference, he got his lunch and he went and sat down at a table with a group of young men. I don't know how many men, 4 or 5 young men. And they were talking about marriage. And they were talking about the sort of women that they wanted to marry, women who were prayer warriors and gave themselves endlessly to pray, and they were diligent students of the Word of God, and they were, you know, very biblically informed and, you know, very, very godly and committed to the church. And they were going on, and he interrupted them and he said, "You men are never going to find anyone to marry. Who on earth lives like this?" He said, "Why don't you just find someone in the church that you're attracted to? That's a godly young woman going to church that you find attractive and just marry them. There's an over spiritual. In fact, he said things to them which could be conceived to be a little bit crude. But I would say they were just very earthy and very sensible. And I think sometimes there is an unnecessary over spiritualizing of things, particularly when it comes to this area. For goodness sake, what on earth is wrong with marrying someone because, at least in large part, you are attracted to them. You like them. You enjoy their company. And of course, not just physical attraction. They make you laugh. You enjoy their company. You are comfortable with them. They are competent people. But the physical dimension also comes into it. It's the way that God made us. George Whitefield fell hopelessly in love with a young woman, and she was besotted with him. And she belonged to a very godly family, and her father was very supportive of his preaching ministry, and he longed to marry her. And one day he plucked up the courage to write to her father asking for her hand in marriage, and he outlined all of the reasons why it would be good for her to marry him, because she would be useful to him in ministry and she was godly and she was willing to sacrifice for the work of the Lord. And so he went on, blah, 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 you know, yours sincerely, you know, your ever faithful servant, George Whitefield. And the response came back to him, no, you can't have my daughter's hand in marriage. And he was greatly shocked because this man seemed to be very affectionate and supportive towards him. And he asked the question, why not? And the response came back to him, because you never said that you love my daughter. Didn't ask me because you love her and you want to be with her. Simply because she could provide all of these benefits to you. Silly man, he did in fact love her deeply. It was a ridiculously over-spiritualizing of the situation. Well, of course she needs to be godly to support him in the ministry, but what on earth is wrong with saying, I love your daughter to bits, and I want her hand in marriage? Now, in all of this, I'm not saying to anybody, of course, just go and find someone because they're good looking and marry them. I'm not suggesting that for a minute. You know, it goes without saying, you're to marry someone who is godly and committed to the life of the church and all of those things. But at the same time, it needs to be said, look at Paul's language. It is so down to earth. There is nothing pretentious and prudish in the language of the Bible. Because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. In other words, we were created for physical intimacy. And sadly, sometimes it doesn't work out for some people, and we will touch on singleness in another sermon from this chapter. Paul doesn't say, because you need a prayer partner, let every man have his wife and every woman her husband, because you need someone to study the Bible with, but because you desire physical intimacy, and rather than falling into temptation and immorality, let every man have his wife and enjoy her, and let every woman have her husband and enjoy him. Sometimes noted over with the ministry of some men who've been in the ministry for decades and decades, and I've observed this, how many never go anywhere near the Song of Solomon. And we know that the language is very earthy, and regardless of how you want to interpret Song of Solomon, it's as though they are just too scared. It's contraband. It's not fit for public consumption. Well, it is fit for public consumption because it's in the Word of God. Regardless of whether or not it may be spiritualized in relation to Christ and the church, the language is very earthy and very natural. And that's the way God made us. We gain nothing by being prudish and over-spiritualizing this issue. Well, secondly, we want to note, second thing I want to draw to your attention is marriage and responsibility. What about married people who may be inclined to embrace this pseudo kind of spirituality which calls for various forms of abstinence? Look at what Paul says in verses 3 and 4. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Now, this language can perhaps be a bit confronting, and, you know, for many people today, and obviously the unconverted, eyebrows would be raised. Husband doesn't have authority over his own body, the wife does. The wife doesn't have authority over her own body, the husband does. Let me explain firstly what Paul doesn't mean, because it could be easily misconstrued. Now, Paul is not saying that spouses have to do things that they are not comfortable with because they are married. Okay, Paul is not saying that someone can force themselves on their partner. He is not saying that in marriage people have no rights. They are the possession of their spouse. He's not saying any of those things, and that's how some would want to interpret Paul, but that's not what he means. Paul is saying that marriage is not just about our own individual needs and desires. We've just noted from verse 2 that it is legitimate to get married because we have desires, but he's making the point then in verses 3 and 4 that marriage goes beyond just what you personally want. You need to remember that your spouse also has needs and desires. Marriage brings with it responsibilities. In other words, there is no room for selfishness. There is no place for sexuality to be used as a weapon or bargaining tool. And that's often how it is used. If I don't get what I want, you won't get what you want. If I do get what I want, you can have what you want. Paul is making the point here that marriage is all about giving. The wife lovingly and willingly giving herself to her husband, and the husband lovingly and willingly giving himself to his wife. And when that's the case, there is no riding roughshod over each other. There is no cruelty. There is no neglect. There is no withdrawing from one another. There is no indifference. You come back to what Paul says about marriage in Ephesians chapter 5 and the way he describes the role of the husband and the wife. Wives are to give themselves to their husbands as the church gives herself to Christ. And husbands are to give themselves to their wives just as Christ gave himself to his church. And the idea is this: we receive as we give. We are blessed as we give. Our needs are met as we give. Husbands and wives need to see themselves as owing a debt to their spouse. A debt of love and affection and devotion. And this comes out in another way. Further into chapter 7, Paul discusses marriage and singleness. Let me just draw to your attention verses 32 to 34. But I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. There is a difference between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy in body and in spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. Now, what Paul is saying here is that single people find themselves in a situation where they are able to devote their time and their energy and resources to serving the Lord in a way that married people can't. Single people don't have the same kinds of responsibilities as married people. Now, if you're single and you want to go on a mission trip for 6 months or 12 months, you're free to do so, aren't you? Provided you don't have other obligations. If you decide you want to support somebody in the ministry and give, you know, a very large portion of your finances to that person, you're free to do so. There's a sense in which you are your own person. Your time is yours, your money is yours, your resources, you have more energy. You can give yourselves to the work of the ministry and the things of God in a way that a married person can't. It's not to say that married people don't serve the Lord, but Paul is making the point that married people have responsibilities in the home. The husband is concerned to look after his wife, and the wife is concerned to look after her husband. And most often there are children involved, and so children need care, they need looking after. Bills need to be paid. The demands are far greater for married people than they are for single people. Paul's point in all of this is to say that a married person cannot live as a single person. The reason being, married people owe a debt to their spouse. A debt that involves time and care and commitment and devotion. Marriage comes with responsibilities. And coming back to the beginning of chapter 7, Paul says in verse 5, "Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." The only abstinence that Paul countenances, at least in terms of marital intimacy, is when a couple would for a period give themselves to seeking the face of the Lord. And Paul makes the point only for a short period. And so it may be in a couple's relationship there may be deep-seated problems. There may be problems in the broader family. There may even be church problems. And so a couple together decide that they are going to refrain for a short period of time to really give themselves to seriously seeking the face of God in prayer and in His Word. And so this abstinence is a kind of fast in itself. We often think of fasting as refraining from food, which it is, but it's not the only kind of fast. Fasting actually means to afflict oneself in order to devote yourself to the things of God more earnestly for a period. Now, obviously, abstinence may happen because of sickness or some other kind of intrusion, but in terms of deliberate abstinence from sexual intimacy within marriage, Paul points out that only for a short time for this spiritual focus. And so this notion of afflicting the body endlessly by denying yourself creature comforts, particularly in the context of marriage, it's completely unbiblical. It's not unspiritual to have a very healthy sex life in marriage. Endless abstinence from sex and being apart from one another for prolonged periods is not biblical. It's not spiritual. In fact, Paul says that it's dangerous. It opens the door to Satan and temptation. Okay, we need to understand, if we are married or we are thinking of getting married, that our spouse or our spouse-to-be, we have a responsibility towards them. We owe them a debt of our time, our affection, our commitment, our intimacy. Now, the third and final point I want us to consider is marriage and equality. Now, under this third heading, I'm really just building a bit further on what I've just previously said. Now, the Bible teaches differences of function within marriage. Obviously, there are differences between men and women, and that translates itself into marriage. Husbands are called to lead, and wives are called to assist. We refer to this as complementarianism. Both roles of husband and wife, when undertaken biblically, complement one another. Now, in the first century, when the New Testament was written, women were basically second-class citizens. It was a man's world, and the role of the woman was to satisfy her husband. If you remember in our series from the Gospel of Mark, not that long ago, maybe a month or so ago, something like that, we touched on the issue of divorce. And I trust, hopefully, most of us will remember from that sermon, and we've touched on this on other occasions as well, that in the world of Jesus and the apostles, men would just get rid of their wives for any reason of their choosing. It was very much a man's world, and if a man felt that his wife had gone past her use-by date, she's looking a bit old and she's had a number of children and that kind of thing, and there's a younger woman that's available to him, then he was free to basically dispose of her in a very carefree and negligent way. And we see when we read through the New Testament that Jesus and the apostles turn all of this on its head. And when we come here to 1 Corinthians 7 and we read what Paul says, it would have been extremely controversial. Look at verse 3. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her. Verse 4, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Now, Paul says the same thing, of course, about wives, but that would have been expected. To include the husband as having these obligations in the first century was revolutionary. In the Jewish Greco-Roman world, the wife was to be there for the husband. Yet Paul is saying here that the husband is also to be there for his wife. Now, I think a lot of husbands are very comfortable with the idea of headship and authority. A lot of husbands even revel in the concept of male leadership, and they're the head of the home, and they've got all of the authority, and they love that, and they love to talk about it and exercise it. And yet some of those men can fall far short of the obligations that God has placed upon them, fail to understand how they are to undertake that headship in a biblical way. I'm not in any way suggesting that husbands need to give into every whim and fancy of their wives. I'm not suggesting that for a minute. I'm not in any sense undermining male leadership. The spineless, unprincipled, wimpy husband is not a good husband, not a biblical husband. But the point is this. The Bible indicates that the needs, concerns and desires of the wife are of equal importance to that of the husband. The needs, desires and concerns of the wife are of equal importance to that of the husband. Paul is saying to the husbands, you have a debt of obligation to your wife, just as your wife has a debt of obligation to you. And so the mindset of both husband and wife is to be that of servitude in the marriage. I don't mean servitude in an oppressive sense, of course, but loving, willing, Christ-like servitude. In conclusion this evening, entitled this series Confusion at Corinth. There was a lot of confusion on many levels in the church at Corinth, and we see it particularly in relation to sexuality and marriage. The Corinthians had been influenced by the standards and philosophies around them. And we live in a day of moral confusion and even chaos. Satan has had an influence in every area of society, but we see it particularly in this area. Distortion of sexuality and the undermining of marriage. We need to understand that we are not immune to the environment that we live in. And we easily grow weary and dull of heart. We need to work toward and pray for strong, healthy, biblically informed marriages. Wives that are not oppressed and husbands that are not weak. Husbands and wives who understand their roles and give themselves to one another in love and devotion. We need to work toward and pray for structure, love, happiness, and discipline in the home. The world needs to see that our homes are different to those around and about. We need to work toward and pray for our children to be well grounded in the teaching of the Bible when it comes to sexuality and marriage. And this is becoming an increasingly important issue. It's always been important, but it's never been more important, I don't think, than now. And as parents, we need to be discussing issues of sexuality from when they are old enough to understand, doing it in a mature and open manner. In my generation, we just learned about sexuality in the playground. I never had a single discussion ever with my father. He never told me anything. I think sadly, Christian fathers, if you have older children and you haven't done it, quite frankly, I'm prepared to say you have completely failed in this issue. You don't teach your children and have open, frank discussions with them, and mothers for that matter, with their daughters, who's going to? Who's going to teach them? You're so prudish and giggly and don't know what to say. The Bible's not prudish. The Bible's very open and frank. And for those of you who have little children, you need to be praying for them now and preparing for this. Our kids are facing a minefield of obscenities and confusion and chaos. Who is going to steer them in the right path if it's not you? And I can only say so much from a pulpit. We need to pray for our children and work toward them being grounded solidly in the teaching of the Bible. Well, may the Lord strengthen us and bless us all in these important areas. Amen.